Well, I want to thank everyone for your presence here, and certainly want to thank the congregation here at 21st Street for inviting me to participate in the study. I told Dwayne and Alan both, as they've talked to me about participating in the study, that I enjoy coming to the study, whether I give a presentation or not, and certainly as I get older, I enjoy just sitting back and listening to those that are younger get up and share the things that they have studied and learned from the Word of God. But I don't mind if I'm asked to give a presentation of some sort. I hope that you don't mind listening to the things that I am going to talk about. The writer of Hebrews begins in Hebrews chapter 1 and says, God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things. Now, I put this passage of Scripture up just to point out that the revelatory process spanned a period of approximately 4,000 years, beginning almost immediately after creation. And the complete plan of God was not revealed all at once. It wasn't given to any one individual in the beginning, but it was portioned out fragmentarily, bit by bit, until everything was made known. And there's nothing to indicate that God spoke to men on a daily basis. Sometimes I hear people today, denominational folks, preachers and those that believe that God talks to them, that God is talking to them every day about something. There's nothing that indicates that that was going on in times past among God's people. There were more than 200 years that elapsed from the days of Noah until the call of Abraham. And in the days of Eli the high priest, we read in 1 Samuel chapter 3 and in verse 1, it says, now the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. Well, so it was from the days of Malachi the prophet until the days of John the Baptist. Approximately 400 years went by, and the body of sacred literature, which we today refer to as the Old Testament, was the medium through which God spoke to Israel and the world at that time, after Malachi had laid down his pen. And it does not appear that holy men of God were being moved by the Holy Spirit with any new revelation from heaven. Now, the period that is between the Old and the New Testament is sometimes called the silent years. Now, such a term or such appellation must be qualified for us to understand it correctly. God certainly was not silent to Israel, because the written word was speaking to their hearts continually. And creation itself was proclaiming the attributes of a divine maker. The psalmist had written in Psalms chapter 19, verses 1 through 4, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Later on, the Apostle Paul would pen in Romans chapter 1 and in verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even as eternal power and Godhead. Now, we should also point out that neither is this time period, that is the period between the book of Malachi and the book of Matthew in our Bible, it's not silent to us. The testimony of eyewitness accounts and secular historians offer us a wealth of information about what was going on in the world, as well as what was happening to Israel. The expression silent years simply means that no new revelation was being given for 400 years during this period, that is, between the time of Malachi and the appearance of the angel Gabriel to Zechariah the priest. So the question that we have before us this afternoon is, what was happening during the 400 years between the Testaments? Well, I'm going to give you several things that will be points of interest. First of all, prophecy was being fulfilled. There are 15 literary prophets and hundreds of others, the majority of whose names we do not know. From the time of Samuel, these men walked among the people of God, calling for right living and faith in God. For the most part, these men spoke only to the children of Israel. Occasionally, they were sent outside of their boundary to make the world aware of the divine presence. And then there was Daniel. Daniel lived before the time that we're speaking of, that is, before this 400-year period. The year was 606 B.C. when Daniel was taken early in life away from the land of promise, and for the most part, away from the children of Israel. He was given the gift of prophecy, but it was not to preach to his wayward countrymen, but rather it was to proclaim to the world the sovereign majesty of God. Daniel lived a life that was completely above reproach. Even those that were evil men, his enemies, acknowledged in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 5, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." And the prophecies of Daniel set the stage for the establishment of the church. Now, modern-day critics would deny the authenticity of the book of Daniel because of his detailed accuracy in speaking about events that were going to come or occur after his day and time, and the things that were going to occur leading up to the advent of the Messiah. But it was this detailed accuracy that confirmed the book and was most convincing to those that were living in that day. I'll talk more about this as we go along. Let me tell you some things that were occurring. There were worldwide political changes that were happening within the world. Daniel had predicted the rise of three successive empires following that of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was carried away into Babylon in the year 606. He lived to see the dawn of the Persian Empire, which is dated from 536 BC, when Darius the Mede conquered the city of Babylon. And thus we have the next empire that he had predicted was going to occur, which is the Persian Empire. And it was during the Persian Empire that inspiration grew quiet. But it wasn't before God had made his presence known worldwide. And I think it's very important that we notice the events that occurred just before that inspiration or revelation, as we should say, came to a standstill for a while. And that was, you have the incident of Daniel in the lion's den. This occurred during the reign of Darius. And it was something that was known throughout the world because Daniel was a prominent individual within the kingdom, and what had occurred became known throughout the world, and the decree that went out after he came out of the lion's den was known to everyone. You also have the event of Mordecai, Esther, who became queen of the Persian Empire. You recall the Haman incident, a very high-profile event that was made known throughout the world. The Jewish people were being put on the map wherever they were as a special people, the people of God. And also, the Jews had received some final messages of hope through the post-exilic prophets like Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, as well as the priest Ezra, and then that man named Nehemiah, a Jew who was a high-ranking official in the court of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. All of these events made known to the world the Jewish population that had by this time been scattered throughout the world. Well, the pen of inspiration had grown silent, and then we have the Greek Empire that comes on the scene. Now, it's interesting when we talk about the Greek Empire. Up to this time, the world empires had come from Asia, from Africa, but looming ominously on the western horizon was the rising power of Greece. And it goes back in the early days of Bible history even. The beginnings of Greek history are veiled in myth. It's thought to have commenced about the 12th century B.C., during the time of the biblical judges. And we read about a lot of events that occur in what we call Greece, or this part of the world. We read of the Trojan War and of Homer, and we read of the First Olympiad, and we read of the Hellenic States and the Persian Wars and those famous battles of the Marathon and Thermopylae. And we read of men named Pericles and Socrates. Now, most of everything that I mentioned was before that this 400-year period has occurred. But in 336 B.C., Alexander the Great appears. He assumed the command of the Greek army, and like a meteor, he swept over the lands that had been under the dominion of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. And by 331, the whole world lay at his feet, and on his invasion of Palestine in 332, he showed great consideration to the Jews. He spared the city of Jerusalem. He offered immunities to the Jews to settle in Alexandria. He established Greek cities all over the conquered domains, and along with them, Greek culture and Greek language. And after a brief reign, he died in 323 B.C. Now, Alexander the Great began his conquest of the world in the year 334 B.C., and it only took him 10 years to conquer the Persian Empire and have a dominion that was larger than any other that had been before him. Now, when Alexander the Great entered the city of Jerusalem, he was shown the book of Daniel, which was already over 200 years old. And there he read prophecies that he rightly interpreted to be about him. This encouraged him to go after the conquest of Persia. And also, because that he had been mentioned within the sacred writings of the Jews, he treated the Jews favorably in regard to their customs and to their laws, and allowed them to have liberties that other peoples that he had conquered, he had not shown this to. This is all recorded in Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews in Book 11. The breakup of the Grecian Empire, though, had also been spoken of in the Book of Daniel. You see, Alexander the Great died in the very prime of his life. He died in the year 323 B.C., and his empire was divided among his generals. Israel was caught in the middle of a struggle between Syrian and Egyptian forces. And on Alexander's death, his empire fell to four of his generals. The two eastern sections going to Syria, to Seleucus, and Egypt in the south to Ptolemy. And Palestine lay right between Syria and Egypt. And first of all, it went to Syria, but shortly then it passed into the hands of Egypt, the year 301 B.C. And it remained under the control of Egypt until 198 B.C. Now, under the kings of Egypt, who were called the Ptolemies, the conditions of the Jews was very good. They remained peaceful, they were happy, and more than that, there were synagogues that were being built throughout Egypt, and the settlements all around the Mediterranean Sea, and the city of Alexandria came to be an influential center of Judaism, a large company of, or colony, I should say, of Jewish people lived in Alexandria. And then, in the year 198 B.C., we find there was the reconquering of Palestine by Antiochus the Great. And Palestine passed back into the hands of the kings of Syria, who were called the Seleucids. And then the successor of Antiochus the Great was a man whose name was Antiochus Epiphanes. Daniel had spoken about this man. He had spoken about all of these events that have occurred thus far that we've been speaking of. But Antiochus Epiphanes was a man who was violently bitter against the Jews. And he made a furious and a determined effort to exterminate them and to do away with their religion. He devastated the city of Jerusalem in 168 B.C. He defiled the temple. He offered a sow on the altar. He erected an altar to Jupiter. He prohibited temple worship, and he forbade circumcision on the pain of death, anyone that was going to practice this. Thousands of Jewish families were sold into slavery. He destroyed every copy of the scriptures that could be found, and he slaughtered everyone that he discovered in possession of copies of the scriptures. He resorted to every conceivable torture to force the Jews to renounce their religion. And of course, this then led to the Maccabean Revolt, which was one of the most heroic feats of Jewish history. And let me talk to you just for a little bit about the period of the Maccabees. This lasted from 167 BC to 63 BC. And it's called the Maccabean era, or the Hasmonean period. And what occurred was a man named Mattathias. He was a priest of intense patriotism and unbounded courage, and he was infuriated at the attempt of Antiochus Epiphanes to destroy the Jews and their religion. And so he gathered a band of loyal Jews, and he raised the standard of revolt. And he had five sons. Their names were Judas, Jonathan, Simon, John, and Eleazar. And Mattathias died in the year 166, shortly after the revolt had started. And his mantle fell onto the shoulders of his son Judas, who was a military leader of amazing genius. He won battle after battle against unbelievable and what many strategists would say impossible odds. He reconquered Jerusalem in the year 165, and he purified and rededicated the temple. And this was the occasion or the origin of the Feast of Dedication that we read about in the New Testament. Judas united the priestly and the civil authority in himself, and thus he established the line of Hasmonean priest rulers who, for the next 100 years, governed an independent Judea. And, of course, these rulers, they were Mattathias and Judas and Jonathan and Simon, and then John Hyrcanus and a son whose name was Jonathan. And these individuals ruled over Judea, and they enjoyed, again, a sense of freedom, a sense of independence, not being subject to foreign powers. But in the year 63 B.C., Palestine was conquered by the Romans under Pompey. And a man whose name was Antipater, he was an Idumean, a descendant of Esau, an Edomite. He was appointed as ruler over Judea, and he was succeeded by his son Herod. And his son later comes to be known as Herod the Great, who was king of Judea from the year 37 to about 3 or 4 B.C. And Herod, in order to obtain favor of the Jews, He rebuilt the temple with great splendor. But he was a brutal man. He was a cruel man. And this is the Herod that was in power, who ruled over Judah when Jesus was born. And it was he who slew the children of Bethlehem. And I'm sure you've heard many stories about Herod the Great, of his violence, his cruelty, and his meanness, his wickedness. He wanted to be sure that all of Jerusalem would mourn when he died. He had ordered the execution of many of the prominent men of Jerusalem when he died, so that the entire city would be in mourning. During this period of history that we're talking about, this 400 period, we have to go back and look at some of the things that were implemented or begun by Alexander the Great, who probably was the most influential of all of the people we're reading about during this period. He was a visionary. He desired not only to conquer the world militarily, but also to establish Greek culture throughout the entire empire. Alexander the Great wanted to see an empire that had a common language, one that everybody could speak and one that everyone could read. And he was very successful. There were libraries and schools that were established during the Grecian Empire throughout the world, and they remained even after his kingdom was divided and even after the Roman Empire came into existence. But during this period, there was a document that was written that's called the Septuagint, and it's simply a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. And it was made in Alexandria, Egypt, where there were many Greek-speaking Jews. And the tradition has it, according to the historians that I've read, that at the request of Ptolemy Philadelphus, about the year 250 B.C., he ruled from 285 to 247 B.C., there were 70 Jews who were skillful linguists that were sent from Jerusalem to Egypt. And the Pentateuch was first translated. That is, the first five books of what we call the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew into Greek. Later, the rest of the Old Testament books were added to the translation. Now, it was called the Septuagint because the initial translation was by 70 translators who started it. And Septuagint has reference to the number 70. Greek was the language of the world at that time. It was spoken throughout the entire empire. And this version, that is the Septuagint, was in common use in the days of Jesus Christ. The New Testament was written in Greek, and many of the quotations that we read in the New Testament are from the Old Testament as the Septuagint. That is, it was the Septuagint translation that was being quoted. Now, let me talk also about what else was occurring. When Rome conquered the world in the year 63, the Roman Empire had several different military legions that was going to keep peace within the empire, within the world as it was. They not only had conquered the world, but they had a powerful enough force that they would be able to maintain the peace. But they wanted to be able to move their military swiftly from one part of the empire to the other. And so they built highways and they built roads throughout the empire. And these roads and highways were built from east to west and north to south, so that the military could move swiftly and quickly from one place to another in case there was a need to put down some sort of rebellion or to take care of some sort of disorderly conduct that might be going on. The soldiers themselves built the roads in order that they might stay in shape and continue to be individuals that would be ready for war if the time would occur. They did a good job. These roads are still in existence today, and even there are some that automobiles drive on, and you can go around parts of Italy and be on roads that you even read about within the Bible, such as the Appian Way. These roads were very important later on in the time of the New Testament, but just want to show that there was a good highway system that existed. Not only did the highway system make it easy to get from one place to another, but it was a safe way to travel because it was policed by the Roman army itself, ensuring that those that were highwaymen, those that were thieves and bandits, would not be lying in wait for pilgrims traveling one way or the other. Well, let's talk also about the diaspora, or the dispersion, as some would refer to it. This is the name of the Jews that were living outside of Palestine. Now, very many of them chose to remain in the lands of captivity. You recall that in the year 722, the Assyrians, under the rule of Tiglath-Pileser, had taken the northern kingdom into captivity. And the northern tribes had been scattered throughout the world to be recolonized in different parts of the Assyrian kingdom. And they remained as such during the entire Assyrian Empire. When the Babylonians came and conquered the southern kingdom of Judah, the Jewish people there also were taken out of Jerusalem, out of Judea, and they were taken into captivity. They were colonized in Babylon. We read in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel speaks about being in a Jewish colony along the river Kibar in Babylon. And there were Jews in other cities of Babylon. They had been taken there simply to get them out of their homeland and to prevent any type of uprising where they tried to revolt against the empire and regain their freedom there in Judea and in Jerusalem. And 70 years later, we find that Cyrus, under the Persian Empire, issued a decree that Jewish people could return to their homeland. Many of them did. We read in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah about the return of Jews to Jerusalem to rebuild the city, to rebuild the temple, and to reestablish their homeland once again. But you know, if you've lived for 70 years, or some of these people, those that have been under the Assyrian captivity, if they had lived for two or three generations in a foreign land, Jerusalem, while it might be referred to as the place of their homeland, that is Judea, Jerusalem being the main city, might be referred to as their homeland, home was really where they lived. If you live for 70 years in a place, you've developed your business, your friendship, your neighborhood, and many folks didn't want to go back, and they remained where they were. And so there grew strong colonies of Jews in every land, in all of the chief cities of the civilized world, in Babylon, in Assyria, in Syria, in Phoenicia, in Asia Minor, Greece, Egypt, in North Africa, and Rome. Now, historically, there were three main divisions of the diaspora, and they were in Babylon, in Syria, and then the Egyptian group. And in the time of Christ, the number of Jews that were in Egypt probably was greater than the number of Jews that were in Judea. It's estimated that in Alexandria alone, there was over 1 million Jews. And there were strong populations in Damascus and in Antioch. So the providence of God turned the captivity into something that was going to be a useful tool in the spread of the Gospels, because the captivities turned out for the benefit of the nations among whom they were scattered. The Jewish people were having a leavening influence on the peoples among whom they were living. The Jews were monotheistic. They believed only in one God, and they were going to only worship one God, and This had an impact on the societies in which they were living. Now, clearly, there was the influence of the heathen societies upon the Jews also, but I find it interesting. When the Jews had been living in the land of Canaan, they rejected God and they wanted to be more like the other peoples of the world. But interestingly, after the Babylonian captivity, the Jewish people no longer wanted to be like other people. Even though they were scattered throughout the known world, the Jewish people remained a distinctive people by their religion and by their dress, by their diet, and by the habits that they had. Now, it's not possible for us to determine when the first Jewish synagogue appeared in their history. There's no mention of a synagogue in the Old Testament. Some have speculated that the synagogue developed during the Babylonian captivity. If so, they're not alluded to by Daniel, by Ezra, by Nehemiah, or any of the post-exilic prophets. It's really not, as we study history, it's not until after the Maccabean period that the synagogue begins to be spoken of very much at all. Jewish theologians sometimes grasp at straws when they start looking for synagogues in earlier times. And I've read Jewish commentaries that talk about there was a synagogue when Abraham built an altar at Bethel, or when the elders were gathering before the prophet Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 1, or when all Israel gathered before Ezra in Ezra chapter 3 and verse 1. But by the first century, we do know this, that according to Acts 15:21, Moses was being preached in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. And it was these synagogues that were utilized by the Lord and his apostles for the propagation of the gospel in the first century. So now we've got a number of things here that show the providence of God was working very effectively for 400 years during the time that is between the time of Malachi and the time of the establishment of the church. We could say when John the Baptist began preaching. God was setting the stage for the gospel to spread throughout the world. And it was done in a way that was going to make it very effective and easy. There was going to be a highway system in which people could travel throughout the world with ease and without fear of being robbed or what have you, because there was not only good roads, but they were well protected roads. We had a common language that was being used throughout the entire world. You know, we don't have to say, well, in order to preach the gospel in the first century preachers had to have the gift of tongues. They simply had to know the language that everybody else knew, and that was Greek. They could preach the gospel throughout the world with the Greek language. It was something that could be read. Paul didn't have to worry when he sent a letter that was going to go to a church that was in Thessalonica, if that letter was going to be copied and sent to the church at Rome or to the church in Jerusalem or wherever, that it would need to be translated for them to read it, because they could all read in the language in which he was writing. We find that there was already this sentiment of monotheism that was starting to make sense even to the heathen world. And so many Gentiles were gathering together at Jewish synagogues just to hear about the God of heaven. Gave a great venue then for the apostles and first century preachers and gospel evangelists, as they would go in and they already had an audience that was ready to hear about the God of heaven. So all of these things put together shows what was going on during this 400 years. Now, this has been a very brief summary. There are books and books that are written, and we could have talked about just one of the aspects of this. I had brethren that suggested, why don't you just talk about prophecy being fulfilled? And others that said, no, why don't you tell about just the period of the Maccabees? I've given you a smattering of all of it so that you can know. I'm ready for questions.